The past few years have seen efforts around the nation to remove Confederate statues and other monuments from public spaces and to remove the names of white supremacists from college buildings and facilities. For many, it feels like an obvious choice to make to stop honoring those who fought to preserve the right to enslave African Americans and who, when they lost the Civil War, used other, often violent methods to terrorize or oppress people of color. Supporters of the monuments say that removing them is a threat to their identity and heritage. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're from the South or have lived there, how prominent were Confederate monuments? What do they mean to you, to the African-American community there, to local white residents? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Connor Town O'Neill's writing has appeared in several outlets, including New York Magazine and Slate. He works as a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies. Originally from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, he lives in Auburn, Alabama, where he teaches at Auburn University and with the Alabama Prison Arts and Education Project. He joined us now for a look at his new book, Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Connor, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
Well, you focus on one particular figure, much monumented in parts of the South, Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Civil War general, ultimately for the Confederacy. Can you tell us a little bit about his story?
Sure. So Forrest was born in 1821, and in his early life sort of moves west along with the frontier as it sort of opened up after the Trail of Tears. He winds up in Memphis and makes a fortune as a slave trader there in that city, which is kind of the inland capital of the slave trade in the decades leading up to the Civil War. By some counts, he becomes one of the richest men in the South by profiting from that human trafficking. When the war breaks out, he uses some of that fortune to equip his own regiment. He enlists as a private in the war, but becomes one of, or the most promoted soldier of the war, North or South, eventually becoming a lieutenant general. After the war, he serves as the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, helping to undermine efforts at Reconstruction, and eventually operates a convict leasing plantation just outside of Memphis, a practice known as slavery by another name. So he's present at these real sorts of flashpoints of, you know, the racist history of America, but is also seen as this kind of instinctive military mind and is revered for that in monuments and names of schools and counties and cities across the South.
And did I read this right? There have been three U.S. presidents from Tennessee, and Nathan Bedford Forrest is more memorialized in Tennessee than all of them. I think you're right. Put together.
That's right. There are more markers to Forrest than to Jackson, Johnson, and Polk combined. So that tells you something about his standing in Tennessee.
Well, I want to step into the story where you first encountered the debate over monuments to Nathan Bedford Forrest. What was your entry point?
Yeah, so this is 5 years ago now, which is crazy to think about. I've been working on this book for 5 years, and it's finally out. So 5 years ago, it was the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the attack by Alabama police officers on nonviolent civil rights demonstrators, the late John Lewis among them, who suffered a skull fracture during that march. But it took place at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. And so I was in Selma 50 years later for that anniversary. President Obama was there to deliver a speech. And as was the case with where a lot of places where Obama went, a ton of people showed up. I think some 40,000 other people showed up, and Selma's a pretty small city. So I had a tough time finding a place to park that morning. So I figured there might be a place to leave my car in the city cemetery. Selma's one of those Southern towns that has one of those cliched Southern cemeteries that think, you know, mausoleums, Spanish moss, it has its own system of roads. So I pull in there, it's just a couple blocks from downtown, and I think I'll stash my car there. I'll walk down and I'll listen to Obama's speech. And I wound up finding way more than I bargained for. As soon as I pulled into the cemetery, I see these signs that say Confederate Memorial Circle closed, no trespassing. And a couple of people sort of scowling in the direction of my car. And that's sort of catnip for a reporter. So I get out of my car and I approach and strike up a conversation with these folks and come to learn that they had really spent the better part of the last two decades fighting about this statue of Nathan Bedford Forrest that they had put up, where it should stand, whether it should stand. That statue was then eventually stolen. And then there was this big court battle about whether they could replace it or not. And when I met them back in 2015, they had just won that court case and were getting ready to replace the statue and dedicate a new one there in the cemetery. And the dissonance of that encounter, having this strange conversation with these neo-Confederates on a day of a major civil rights anniversary, it kind of gave me whiplash. I didn't know a ton about Forrest at the time, but this encounter raised all of these questions about who he was, what it meant to put up a statue to him in 2015, and to do it in a place like Selma that is synonymous with the civil rights movement and with Black voting rights. So I went down this rabbit hole of Forrest and his monuments in the months after that encounter, thinking, you know, there might be an essay there, something about statues and Selma and history. And then that summer, though, it all changed when Dylan Roof went to Mother Emanuel AME Church in South Carolina and murdered nine of the parishioners there and in an attempt to start a race war. And after he was apprehended and images from his blog started to circulate, it was revealed that he had taken this strange sightseeing tour around the state, visiting Civil War monuments, slave memorials, plantations, as a way to sort of steel himself almost for this act of terrorism that he would go on to commit. And so in the aftermath of that, campaigns across the country broke out to try and remove the Confederate flag from prominent places where it was displayed. And of course, campaigns to try and remove Confederate monuments as well. And because I had this really strange encounter with the Friends of Forrest specifically, I started following campaigns that were aimed at removing Forrest statues in particular. And so I've spent the last couple of years following campaigns in a couple of different cities and talking with the people that are trying to get them down and with the people that are fighting to keep them up.
For the people who were fighting to keep them up or to put them back up, they talk about Nathan Bedford Forrest as they talk to you in a present tense almost about fighting alongside him. Could you talk a little bit about their perspective, why they feel this connection and what they mean when they want a monument up?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand Forrest in contrast to someone like Robert E. Lee. Lee was, you know, one of the first, the Lees are one of the first families of Virginia. Lee, the sort of embodiment of the Southern gentleman, went to West Point. Forrest, you know, didn't go to West Point, hardly went to school at all. I think his supporters see him as something of a self-made man, although I use that with heavy scare quotes on it, because of course he made his fortune through human trafficking. But I think that that's part of his memory there. And because Forrest didn't go to West Point, didn't start the war as a general, fought in the less prominent battles of the war, I think, you know, in the time since the war, increasingly people come to see him as, you know, what could have been if only Forrest had been given a more prominent role in the war than maybe the South would have won. So, you know, these days, the people that want to Monday morning quarterback the Civil War, as it were, really turn to Forrest as their great white hope. So, you know, promising that the South will rise again is a way of sort of turning to Forrest as the lodestar for a lot of that teeth gnashing and saber rattling. So yeah, I think that accounts for some of his popularity. I think of course they revere him for his instinctive military mind. There's and with that a sort of dismissal of expertise in favor of a kind of more natural, as it were, a more natural instinctive knowledge. Of course, though, it would be remiss not to say that it's no coincidence that the first Grand Wizard of the Klan that has so many monuments and markers of him throughout the South.
We're talking now with author Connor Town O'Neill about his new book, Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. He's a producer on the NPR podcast, White Lies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you think should get to decide who is commemorated or how in memorials? What do you think of the meaning of memorials to Civil War leaders from the Confederate side, especially ones associated with the rise of the Ku Klux Klan afterward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Connor Town O'Neill. His new book is Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning With Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Cross Plains. Mike, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I will admit that there are a lot of unsavory characters from history that we really shouldn't celebrate. However, I get really nervous when statues and monuments and memorials from the past are taken down at the request of a certain group or because that, like it or not, that is history. And I'm a firm believer that when you start whitewashing your history or changing or editing or circumventing it anyhow, you lose a little bit of that. And yeah, it might be something terrible, but that is history. You know, people that go, like, for example, you go to Auschwitz and you take the tour there. It's a terrible thing. But what better way to teach than to show it?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a common argument, Connor, but as you point out in the book, the putting up of these monuments was part of a big campaign to rewrite Civil War history in the first place.
That's right. Yeah. And I think it's important to make the distinction that monuments aren't history. History resides in books and in archives and in records. Monuments are about honoring someone. Auschwitz is not a monument. Auschwitz is a memorial and is careful to build a context not meant to honor what happened there, but rather to mourn it. And to attempt to reckon with it. So you know, statues of Forrest or Lee or other Confederate statues, they're not about telling the history of the Civil War. And like you say, you know, they really only start to go up at the turn of the 20th century after Reconstruction had been undermined and former Confederates had returned to power and started to implement, you know, white supremacist policies, Jim Crow laws. So the statues, I think, are an embodiment of that return to power and that return to, frankly, white supremacist rule. So they're not history. They're about intimidation and about a reassertion of a sort of old South ethos in the new South. And I think actually it's the referendum that we've seen in the last couple of years about Confederate monuments, Civil War history more broadly, and what we're starting to see with our founding fathers too, I think is not whitewashing of that history, but a real expansion of our understanding of the history and the consequences of that history. So I think the more people are thinking about how the Civil War history is still with us and how we need to tell a more honest story about what the Confederacy was and what it stood for and how the beliefs of the Confederacy long outlasted the 4 years of the Civil War. I think that's been really important and really urgent. So it means statues are coming down, but I think it means a better understanding of public history. So in that way, I think history is well served, by the attack on monuments that we've seen recently.
Thanks for that call. And that reminds me, you share a story in Memphis of a church leader who realizes their church is next door to, I think, one of Bedford Forrest's workplaces. And there's a little commemoration marker that doesn't tell a lot. And what did they do to try to flesh out the story?
That's right. That was a really powerful moment. So there's a Calvary Episcopal Church in downtown Memphis. In the parking lot of their church is for the last several decades has been a one of those blue historical markers to Forrest that says that his early business dealings were on this site. or rather his home was here, and references his early business dealings. Those, what they're being coy about there is that his slave market was on that property that is now the parking lot of this church. And when a member of that church realized what was being obfuscated by that sign, and the fact that, you know, the church was operating in the 1850s while their backyard was for a slave market, he decided that and with the agreement of the church, that they should do some truth telling about that, that they should really square up to the fact that, you know, at the early history of this church, it was next door to a slave trader and to that slave market. And so they held this ceremony, in which they found as many of the names of the men and women who had been trafficked through that market and read their names and unveiled a new marker that told more of the truth about what was happening on that site and attempted to be more honest about what had happened in that city. And I think it was really poignant because he points out, you know, that for the parishioners of that church in the 1850s, it would have seemed pretty natural. It wouldn't have seemed that strange that they were next to a slave market. It was just sort of the water that they swam in. And so, one of the rectors at the church asked those present to really think about the ways that we're sort of swimming in injustice as well, and to use a reckoning with our past to help better sensitize us to injustices in the present. What is happening that we're not paying attention to now, that we might be called to be more aware of and responsible for? And I found that really moving and important.
Talking to Connor Town O'Neill, his new book is Down Along With That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning With Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy. Let's bring on another caller now. Jane is with us in Oconto. Jane, hi.
Hi. I have to say I agree with you that they do not belong up, the statues, at least not on public property. Traditionally, historically, one erected statues, particularly of people in military uniforms and or on horseback as a way to honor them, and we simply should not be doing that. They were traitors. They were trying to destroy the United States. They should not be on public ground. If some fool wants to put one up in his own backyard, go for it. But they should not be on public ground.
Jane, thanks a lot for the call. Let's focus on the public ground part of that a little bit, Connor, because that's an issue in at least some of the stories you tell, whether these statues should be on public property and what constitutes public property in some cases.
Yeah. I think Jane makes a good point. Because for these monuments to be on public property, you can read them, you know, as an expression of power, of economic power, of political power, of racial power, in the present, even though they're seeking to honor a figure from the past. They're also about, you know, the politics in the present day. These monuments don't just go up by accident, right? They're expressions of people, they're expressions of people wielding power. So yeah, and you can read who gets remembered, who gets immortalized, brought into the present with us through these monuments, as a reflection of the values of the place where they're standing. And to Jane's point, you know, these were traitors, you know, fighting explicitly. If you look at the documents of secession or the speeches that Confederate politicians were giving, they were telling anyone who would listen in the 1850s that the Confederacy was a project about protecting and expanding slavery into the West. And they were doing it on the explicit idea that the people that they were enslaving were inherently inferior by virtue of their race. So it's, you know, it's an explicitly a white supremacist project. They're fighting to create an ethno state. So to honor them on public property now tells you something about the values of that place where they stand.
Thanks for that call. And I want to spend our last couple of minutes, Connor, you talked to people, African-American residents in Selma, Alabama, and also and up in Tennessee as well, about what it meant to them to have forest monuments standing there or rebuilt in the middle of their communities. Can you share some of what you heard?
Yeah, one of the most poignant reflections I heard was from a student at Middle Tennessee State University, where there's a building on campus named after Forest Hall. And they talked about taking a different route across campus to avoid the building because they didn't want to be reminded on their walk to 9 a.m. biology that their campus was honoring someone who didn't consider them a human being. And I felt that I felt moved by that. That was, I think, a very incisive way to put it. Partly because one of the debates that was happening on MTSU's campus was whether they should keep the name, change the name, or keep the name with added context. That is to say, you know, put some plaques up around the building that explained why the school had chosen to name the building after this, when they named the building after after Forrest, and some of the motivations behind it, and the fact that it was controversial, and doing a little bit more truth telling. And early on in the reporting of the book, I was curious about that third option, that sort of added context option. You know, what would it be to really tell the truth about why in 1958, 4 years after the Brown v. Board decision, but 4 years before the school would even actually integrate, what it meant for them to name a building after Forrest in that time period. And if they could tell the truth about that, I wondered if, you know, what, whether that could be powerful, a statement to make. But that comment from the student, I think helped me to recontextualize how I was thinking about the question. That added context doesn't do anything, to the insult and the degradation, that these sorts of Confederate monuments and honorifics convey to people of color in this country.
Connor, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. I appreciate you talking with me.
Connor Town O'Neill is a producer on the NPR podcast White Lies and a writer whose work has appeared in several print and online outlets. He joined us today to talk about his new book. It's called Down Along with That Devil's Bones, A Reckoning with Monuments, Memory, and the Legacy of White Supremacy.